A little UK soul there, a beautiful lament from Simply Red, Holding Back the Years from 1985. We're talking with Kathleen Martin and Stan Friedman about their new book, Fact, Fiction, and Flying Saucers. We've just got started, even though 2 hours have already gone by. In this hour, we will allow Kathleen to finish the story she was telling about what had happened to Travis Walton from his encounter with Philip Klass. I want to find out from Stan who he thinks Phil Klass may have been working for, if anyone, or whether was this just personal zeal, and whether or not there is a Phil Klass operating today, just a different name, or several of them. So much more to come here at Coast to Coast AM. Don't know about you, but the Travis Walton case is always one that I felt is very powerful and very credible. What happened to Travis and his co-workers is astonishing, yet believable, and there's a lot of evidence to support that account. Before the break, Kathy Martin was telling us some of the things that were done to Travis, and it's pretty outrageous looking at it in retrospect. Please continue.
It absolutely is outrageous. Klass went after that young man in any way that he possibly could. It reminds me of sharks going after a piece of dead meat. But he wanted to tear him apart, not only to ruin the story, but to ruin Travis for the rest of his life through his speculation, through his manipulation of individuals who lived in Snowflake and the surrounding area. In one example I was giving, Klass had spoken with the chief deputy clerk at the Navajo County Court, and he wanted to know if Walton had a criminal record. And he was informed that he did not have a criminal record. But somehow, Klass was able to extract information from somebody that when Walton was a teenager, he had made a mistake, and that he had used a forged check, the funds from a forged check that a boy had given to him, and that the record had been expunged because of Travis's good behavior. He was a good boy. But what had happened was that this other boy, not Travis, during a coffee break, had torn two checks out of the company's checkbook. And he had written the checks out, he cashed the checks, and he gave the money to Travis, and both of them went out and bought a pair of boots for themselves. Now, the company owner was never going to bring charges. He told Philip Klass, "I have the written document on that." And so what happened was that the bank ended up bringing charges, and the boys were found guilty of taking the checks and had to do a little bit of community service, and the record was expunged, as it is with many teenagers who make a stupid mistake and never repeat that kind of behavior again. But Klass used that as a means of destroying Travis's character, and in doing that, could have denied Travis many employment opportunities for the rest of his life, because that story always followed him around. And it's a terrible thing, in my opinion, that he did. And the owner of the company was asked what his impressions of Travis were. And he said that Travis was a good kid, that he was always joking around. As I said, that he was at his house. He was his son's friend. He spent the night over there. But he said that after this experience, Travis had changed, that he was quiet, he was jumpy, that he could tell that something was really wrong. Klass ignored all of the information that could possibly have supported the reality of Travis's abduction and went after Travis, no holds barred, to destroy that young man.
Stan, in the book, you and Kathleen detail how the Robertson panel was created, how it quickly came to a conclusion that UFOs are not a threat, that there's nothing to it, and a conclusion as well that What needed to happen was to strip the subject of its aura of mystery to, in effect, ridicule UFO witnesses and intimidate folks. There are those in ufology, as you know, who don't think that the Robertson panel recommendations were ever initiated. What do you think?
Well, I think there was a major effort and every opportunity where it could be done to ridicule, to raise an eyebrow, to make sure that people thought the wrong things about what was really happening with the flying saucer situation. And, you know, sometimes it's subtle, sometimes it's not so subtle. My University of Chicago classmate for 3 years, Carl Sagan, in two different books said there are interesting sightings that aren't reliable. There are reliable sightings that aren't interesting, but there are no interesting and reliable sightings. Totally false. No data to support it, but it's in two different books that Carl wrote, and he was highly respected, as he should be. He did more to get people thinking about extraterrestrial life than anybody, but not the UFO stuff. And, you know, that's part of the situation here, that the SETI community, for example, has been searched for extraterrestrial intelligence, SETI. I say it stands for Silly Effort to Investigate. They have, at every opportunity, said nothing to flying saucers. You can't get here from there. It would take too long, blah, blah, blah. And they don't deal with the UFO data. In Seth Shostak's book, and we debated on Coast to Coast, as a matter of fact, and I got 57% of the vote. Seth got 33%, and 10% said, I don't know who won. But the SETI community has, at every opportunity, tried to put down UFOs. I mean, let's face it. If aliens are coming here, who needs to listen for radio signals being produced by technology that we don't know anything about and for purposes we know nothing about? You know, maybe we should learn sign language. There's enormous evidence that's being totally ignored by the SETI community that aliens are visiting and that there is a government cover-up and that interstellar travel is possible. If you want to spend the dough, you can go. That's my line on that, if you'll pardon that. Not great line, so that we have to deal constantly. At least Seth debated me. Michael Shermer of the Skeptics Society, who is constantly taking pot shots at UFOs, he and I debated on Coast to Coast. I got 80% of the vote because he didn't know anything. He hadn't done his homework.
What about Bill Nye?
Well, I met him again with Larry King, as a matter of fact. And as an example of the level of his scientific effort, he pointed out a letter where there was some blacking out of a name and address. And he said, there's no cover-up. That's just a privacy kind of thing. Fortunately, I had with me a copy of my book, Flying Saucers and Science, in which I had one of these blacked-out documents, and I could say, you know, here 80%, 90% of the page is blacked out. We're not talking about somebody's name and address. And Bill's explanation for the Malmstrom Air Force Base case, it was just something went off, a short circuit. The system is, you know, triple protected against that kind of thing. This is a case where UFO shows up and the 10 ICBMs with nuclear missiles go offline, one after the other, which isn't supposed to happen at all. But Bill explained that away. Any data to support it? None. So, yeah, he's one of the successors to Phil Klass, you could say. Not the only one, but for example, what's his name? Markowitz was his. Well, Neil deGrasse Tyson. Yeah, that was the other example I was trying to think of. He's the guy who's a very competent astronomer, head of the observatory in New York. He said the proof that the government can't keep secrets is how much we know about President Clinton's genitalia. Got a great laugh at this is at Penn State University. It's a public discussion. which is utterly nonsensical. It's easy to prove the government can keep secrets, unless you can tell me what's under all that whiteout and all the blackout and all the rest of that stuff. And, you know, here's a man who's very competent, sharp, who comes across very well on television, making statements that have no basis in fact.
Well, I remember about Carl Sagan. You said he was your classmate. It seems to me I remember reading stuff that he wrote earlier in his career that was fairly friendly to the subject matter, and then somewhere he took a left turn.
Yeah, it was. He was warned, I think, by Menzel, as a matter of fact, about flying straight. And, you know, he got by. He didn't have to say that there was anything to flying saucers. And he even referred to Phil Klass as an expert on details on documents, which was nonsense. On the other hand, as I say, he did more than anybody else to get people interested in the reality of extraterrestrial beings. Now, in contrast, here's the kind of thing Klass got away with. Klass said that the ratio of believers to non-believers is like 1 to 11. So 10 times as many non-believers as believers. No public opinion poll has shown, not even the early ones. It's more the other way around.
That's baloney. Yeah.
Yeah, it is baloney. But he had the luxury of not having to provide any evidence to back it up.
Let me ask you this then. You first, Stan, and then you, Kathleen. Do you think to this day that Phil Klass was working for someone, that he was doing the bidding of an agency or entity of some sort, or was this just personal zeal on his part?
I personally think it was a bit of both. Phil had strong views about himself and his own importance and stuff. On the other hand, he was in such a good position to be of service to, say, Majestic 12, being in Washington, traveling, having a good reason to be at conferences where he could hear what our guys were saying and what the Russians were saying, that it would seem to me that it would have been ridiculous for them not to use him. Maybe talking with appropriate people, laying out what they wanted. I'm not saying he was on the payroll.
Kathy?
Klass's FBI files show that at one point he was under suspicion of espionage. The FBI went into his apartment. They searched his apartment. The landlady actually let them in. Klass wasn't at home. They were looking for radio equipment that he might be using to listen to what was going on in the Soviet Union, or perhaps communicate with people there. He had a relationship with a young man who worked at the Soviet embassy. They did a lot of things together. He was invited to parties there. I have found that many of the individuals who later became involved in this cover-up were under suspicion of un-American activities. And I'm wondering if somehow this is related, that, okay, we'll let you go, but you owe us a favor. I can't prove that. It's sort of guilt by association and speculation on my part. But I found it interesting that I found this time and time again. And so I do think that Klass might have been working for a three-letter agency. Either he was paid in cash or he was paid in favors. We know that he, through Edward Condon's recommendation, became the go-to guy for the mainstream media. So that was a big perk for Philip Klass, that he had the opportunity to go on to television, to go on to radio, to debunk all of this. Klass had a very large ego, and he would have been very happy with this. The question I had to ask is, did he have a personality disorder that drove him to destroy other individuals, to destroy their character, to launch all of these attacks against them, to spread disinformation throughout the world? Or was he paid to do this? You know, Stan told me that he had spoken with somebody. We weren't able to find specific evidence that he worked for a three-letter agency, but this person told Stan that class was observed in a secure area and that he could not have been there unless he had the security clearance to be there. You know, so that's hearsay. That's something that a scientist, I believe it was, told Stan.
Did the two of you believe his files, his personal papers, were scrubbed?
I think they must have been. Certainly they didn't have a file on me, like I say, and we had a lot of correspondence over more than 20 years.
Also in the book, you go into the idea of disinformation, misinformation. People who want to dismiss this this topic would have a hard time believing, I think, that censorship was ever imposed on people who wanted to speak about it, or that UFO organizations were infiltrated, spied upon. But all that stuff is real. Stan, starting with you.
Well, yeah, there are a number of instances where things got lost that were supposedly analyzed by a government agency. The data didn't come out. There was a lot going on. And, you know, for many people, I've spoken at over 600 colleges, and I have had people tell me that, look, don't let anybody know I'm interested in this subject. Professors at colleges and places like that. There was a tone created that made it difficult for people to get involved with serious research, publication, and so forth. There have been over a dozen PhD theses about UFOs, which there should have been a heck of a lot more. And what I'd love to see is the will not to believe. Why is it that the media, for example, haven't done a better job? Why has the scientific community avoided dealing with this in an upfront way? There have been courses taught at the college level, very few. There should have been far more when you consider some of the courses that are being taught at colleges. So, yeah, that's a problem. There are people who think they can get on the right side of the world by attacking UFOs. And, well, a specific example, Dr. Joseph Nickel, his degree is in English, mind you, professor, has on a couple of occasions said things that were ridiculous, that about Roswell, for example. And an unnamed public information officer put out an unauthorized press release. And, you know, it's utterly ridiculous. All the serious books about Roswell talk about Walter Hout. And there's no question that Colonel Blanchard, who was commander of the base in the 509th, ordered him to put out the press release. So why would he say something like that? He repeated it 8 years later, after we had done a radio show. We were both being interviewed. We were in different locations. And where he had said that, that was his explanation. And I pointed out that, you know, everybody, you don't even know his name? No. Well, what kind of research is that?
Well, I remember also something similar, Carl Sagan, who we mentioned a couple of minutes ago, who's, you know, a brilliant guy in his field, yeah, and a great writer. Toward the end of his life, he wrote an article, I think, for Parade about alien abductions, and, yes, in which he basically wipes people, you know, the whole thing away as being some psychological aberration way, way outside his field.
Yeah, and I chastised him about that, and then I found out we were going back and forth, and I was challenging him to a debate. Then I found out he had serious cancer, and I stopped the challenge. I mean, you know, this is a friend. This is somebody I'd known 20 years earlier, more than that.
Along the way, you know, there have been, although the government investigators concluded only 2% of the cases are hoaxes, I wonder if that still holds to be true. When we come back, we'll get into the effects of the Internet and CGI, also the role of the media. And then I want to ask the two of you if there are any cases that you found in these files that scared you. Much more to come here. Susie Boggess takes us into the break. The song is I've Had Enough from Wings, a 1978 London Town album, sort of an underrated album in my estimation. We're talking with Kathleen Marden and Stanton Friedman about their new book, Fact, Fiction, and Flying Saucers, they had to pour through a lot of government documents to put this piece of work together. And you have to wonder, are there any cases in there that really kind of unsettled them, that scared them, when you realize the implications of the intrusions or encounters, the kinds of things that we're talking about that have been studied by our government in secrecy. We'll get into that and more right after this. You know, you look at the big picture, we've been talking about these debunkers who have really muddied the waters over the years and have inflicted a lot of pain on people who've had strange experiences who didn't ask for these kinds of experiences. Along with that, as you detail in the book, there's disinformation and misinformation, confusion on purpose, where apparently government folks, in some cases, promise information, the release of photos or videos, and then pull the promise back at the last minute. As you detail in the book, Kathleen, there's a promise made to the Disney folks. Hey, we're going to give you some photos, real-life UFO photos, so you can make a documentary. There was a guy named Robert Emmenegger who was promised film of a UFO landing. As you note in the book, Linda Howe was promised some stuff at one point, some video footage that would be very dramatic, and then the promise was never fulfilled. There's that whole Paul Benowitz episode where he was fed disinformation and sort of went off the deep end and had tragic results. It seems like the people who muddy the waters as a part of their profession are really good at it. Kathy, your thoughts first?
It certainly does seem that way. And getting back to the archival documents at the American Philosophical Society, I found letters, very cordial letters, between Donald Menzel and Philip Klass that suggest they were working together. And as Menzel grew older, in one letter he wrote to Klass and stated that he had to go back and debunk these UFOs again, and he was tired of doing this, and that he was happy to have Klass on his side now to assist him with this. I found another letter that Menzel had written to Carl Sagan. And as you mentioned a little bit earlier, Sagan seemed to be taking a fairly objective view of the study of UFOs early on in his career. But the letter that I found was distressing because Menzel suggested to Sagan that he had a bright career on the horizon, and that when Menzel was a young man, he strayed from the zeitgeist of the old guard, and that his associates at that time, his supervisors, convinced him that he needed to toe the party line, so to speak, and that he was rewarded for doing this. And he suggested to Sagan that he do the same, and that if he wanted to write about UFOs, he should write fiction, just the way that Menzel had been writing fiction.
Well, it's almost like a threat, though, too.
It did seem like a veiled threat to me, and I was delighted to find that letter, as frightening as it was, because if that is happening over and over again, then our young scientists are going to have to adhere to scientific materialism and not be able to explore anything on the frontiers of science. And it is certainly in opposition to scientific exploration. And I think, in my opinion, it's unethical.
Stan, same kind of question in this context as well, is that, you know, the big picture where they muddy the waters, it's one thing to deny that UFOs are real, to hide information. It's quite another to be proactive and go out and purposely mislead the public, to sow disinformation, to make liars out of people, to ruin reputations. I remember, I think you guys mentioned it in the book, about how the CIA had written this historical report that said, half of all UFO sightings can be explained. It's our spy planes. It's a U-2 and SR-71, though it's ridiculous. I mean, it's flatly ridiculous that eyewitnesses are not describing those kind of vehicles. They're describing something else.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, that got a lot of publicity, the fact that the CIA historian had done a study, so-called, and showed that, that there wasn't really anything to this. And the CIA's role in this whole thing is complicated. I don't know what went on. But there's a point here that we haven't talked about, and that is the fact that Kathy mentioned the Robertson panel, the CIA scientific look at UFOs way back when. The Robertson panel report was only secret. It wasn't top secret. And that's a very important distinction. Because if, and the same applies to this Majestic 12 stuff, if you look at the fact that certainly Roswell and the other crash cases would be considered top secret. We have a Canadian document saying that America thought that the UFOs were more, the most classified subject, even more so than the H-bomb. This is in the early 50s, mind you, which is a very strong statement indeed. And the problem here is, how do you get away from the public being taken in by these reports, the things like the Robertson panel, which General Twining's letter, Nathan Twining's letter, describing UFOs and stuff, and said something about, well, the absence of physical evidence got in the way, that sort of thing, when in fact, in a secret memo, they couldn't talk about Roswell. And that's a very important thing. That's why I mentioned early on the NSA top secret umbra, no less, all wiped out. 156 documents, one sentence per page you can read. Everything else is wiped, is whited out, wiped out, same thing. That's an important part of the problem here, is that we haven't been able, and I don't know whether the press doesn't know or doesn't care, but when I see a reputable scientist, and I mention this in the book, say that in today's world you can't keep anything secret, my goodness, where has he been living, you know? You can. And, you know, just as an example of keeping things secret, when we were the Manhattan Project to develop the atomic bomb, but they needed to separate uranium, get enriched uranium, and only 0.7%, less than 1% of the uranium atoms are U-235, the one we want. Well, we built a mile-long facility. This is in the middle of the World War II, mile-long facility that was using 5% of all the electricity being produced in the United States to pump uranium gases through the facility and gradually enrich, because U-235 is lighter than U-238, 5% in secret. And I think of the stealth aircraft. Now we all know there are stealth aircraft out there. They're expensive. But I wonder how many people realize it costs $10 billion to develop stealth by Lockheed in secret. In top secret, I should say, I suppose. But we need a more realistic investigation of what the government is really doing. And I appreciate the fact that we're trying to keep stuff from the Russians, or in the case of World War II, the Germans and Japanese and so forth, about what was going on. Well, as a classic example, the first atom bomb explosion, Trinity site in New Mexico, that was seen from 100 miles away, George. And there were a lot of calls to the sheriff's office, what's going on, you know. And this is in before the war was over. And the government said it was just an ammunition dump that had blown up, and fortunately nobody was injured. A few weeks later, after Hiroshima and Nagasaki, they admitted that it was a nuclear weapon explosion. But governments do lie. Sometimes it's necessary. But it would be nice to know that serious people in the world are thinking about the consequences of our being visited. You know, let me give a little sense of perspective here. There's the Kepler data, the Kepler satellite, which is a marvelous device, looking for planets that go in front of their star and therefore reduce the light coming from the star. And we can measure that, which seems incredible in itself, indicates that there's between 1 and 1.6 planets per star. Some have 10, some have none. Now, that means for us here in our local neighborhood, within 100 light years of here, that means there are 10,000 planets. 10,000 within 100 light years, and the galaxy is 100,000 light years across. And so that is a wake-up call. Now, wait a minute. Where do we fit into this scheme of things? Are we the most advanced civilization out there? I doubt it.
Let me ask you, Stan, the same question I asked Kathleen is about the, it's sort of like Lucy pulling the football back from Charlie Brown, the instances where people are promised spectacular information, the Disney people, Linda Howe, Emin Egger, Paul Benowitz was fed disinformation, lying about UFOs, covering it up, holding back the information is one thing, but actually sowing false information, misleading people, or making promises you never intend to keep, that's really something different. I don't understand it exactly.
Well, I think those in charge of national security would say, well, it's for your own good. We have to do this, and yes, sometimes we have to lie to the public, but we are misleading the Russians, or whoever the current enemy number one is, the Chinese, whatever. And this may sound strange coming from me, I talk about the cosmic Watergate and stuff like that. I don't think we should release everything we have. But I certainly don't like the idea of lying intentionally and winding up with disparagement of people. And I get people who've told me I've never told anybody about this case when they talk. I mean, I bet you have too.
Sure.
And I respect them. Okay, I can understand that. But it is a part of our society we don't talk about enough, that the government feels it's perfectly okay to lie when the situation warrants it. That's kind of scary.
And yet the two of you sort of address the issue of disclosure, the idea advanced by Stephen Bassett, Stephen Greer, that we're on the edge of the cusp of some big disclosure, that they're going to open the hangar doors or open the files or...
Yeah,
Kathleen, you first, and then Stan. Give me your take on that.
Personally, I think that it would take a great deal of preparation for even limited disclosure to take place. And once you open that can, is it going to be a can of worms? And how will the public react to that? I'm not certain that the public worldwide is prepared to hear that there is an alien presence visiting Earth if our military and our governments from around the world cannot reassure the world population that everything is going to be okay, that everyone is going to be safe. But if you open that idea just a little bit, that can of worms, then all of those worms might jump out. And you might have to, the government might have to explain why they've covered up Roswell for almost 70 years. What about the bodies that so many people have testified they saw and covered up with the Roswell crash? What about people who are being abducted by aliens? Certainly, there have been some very, very good cases historically, such as Betty and Barney Hill, such as Travis Walton, such as the three women from Kentucky, Charlie Hickson and Calvin Parker. It goes on, and there are credible cases today. I wrote about some of these credible cases in the Alien Abduction Files with Denise Stoner. And how can the government release any information if they're going to have to tell the population of the world that, yes, we have these credible cases of abduction as well. There's nothing that we can do to protect any of these people from being taken. It's going on with impunity. And sorry, folks. So just opening information to the public in terms of limited disclosure could bring so much more information that could cause real problems in terms of national security worldwide. And at the same time, we would all have to join together as governments, as world governments, not in nationalistic approaches toward one another, but as a whole world kind of agreement and work together. And it's difficult for me to imagine that we could possibly be close to that as well.
And Stan, you've addressed this many times over the years, addressing the idea of excessive secrecy, lies that are told. You don't like that. But as you make it clear in this book and in other interviews that we've done before, the idea that there's going to be some disclosure anytime soon seems unrealistic.
Yes, I do think it's unrealistic. For example, what happens to religion? Do we have a contingency plan ready to roll? Will the religious leaders go along with that? Some of the fundamentalists have said all the intelligent life in the universe is right here on planet Earth, and all this UFO stuff is demonic. How can we handle that if a large segment of the public is certainly panicked, not by fear they're going to bomb us or kill us or anything like that, but they're going to upset our long-held beliefs about God and where we fit in the scheme of things. There are times when I'm tempted to say that this is a penal colony. They dumped all the bad boys and girls here, and that's why we're so nasty to each other. And it's the nastiness, I think, that comes across to the aliens. I mean, look at our track record. World War II, we killed 50 million of our own kind. Some say 60, but I'm a conservative guy. You know that, George. We have exploded 2,000 nuclear weapons. We destroyed 1,700 cities during the war. I think that the rest of the local galactic neighborhood would not think too kindly about us going out there. And Hastings' book on nukes and UFOs makes some strong points about aliens being concerned about us. Now, shouldn't they be? I mean, look at the world in which we live. The military budget this year of planet Earth is just $1 trillion. And how many kids died of starvation yesterday? So we've got some problems here in trying to put this in some kind of rational perspective, and I find that difficult. I don't expect there to be and I can understand why not, a massive release of data. And another part of that, as soon as you open up with some data, there are a lot of guys still alive who have pieces of the puzzle who haven't spoken because the rules say you can't. And once the
egg is cracked,
you can't put it back in. How many people would come forth? And people, I had a clearance for 14 years. There are times when you really don't like keeping secrets. And especially if you've been involved in something as close as seeing an alien body, for example. Or how many cases I've had seven different people tell me of planes being launched from military bases to chase UFOs and never coming back. How do you put that out on the table?
Well, disclosure also depends on what's being disclosed. You know, we know that these agencies know more than the general public does, but maybe no one has a real firm grip on the ultimate truth. Maybe the truth is something really ultimately disturbing. It's not just visitors from somewhere else popping in and out. It's that we're food. We're an agricultural product. We're being harvested. Do you want to disclose that? Because I'm not so sure that the ultimate truth is something that that the public really is ready for, or that the government is ready to release.
I agree with you, George.
We're talking with Stan Friedman and Kathleen Martin about their book, Fact, Fiction, and Flying Saucers. I do want to ask the question about each of them, whether there are cases that really scared them. We'll do that on the other side of the break, and then we'll open up the phone lines with your questions and comments from my guests. Much more to come in the final hour of Coast to Coast AM.